Good morning. Today is Joshua 9, verses 16 through 24. In your pew Bibles, it's page 344 and 345. 3 days after they made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. So the Israelites set out and on the third day came to their cities, Gibeon, Kephirah, Beeroth, and Kiriath Jearim. But the Israelites did not attack them, because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. The whole assembly grumbled against the leaders, but all the leaders answered, "We have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now. This is what we will do to them. We will let them live, so that wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath we swore to them." They continued, "Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community." So the leader's promise to them was kept. Then Joshua summoned the Gibeonites and said, "Why did you deceive us by saying, 'We live a long way from you,' while actually you live near us? You are now under a curse. You will never cease to serve as woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God." May God add to the blessing of his word.
The movie Catch Me If You Can, I don't know if some of you might have seen that, is based on the life of Frank Abagnale Jr. This is the true story of a man who, before he was even 19 years old, had forged over $4 million of bad checks and had successfully pretended to be an airline pilot and a doctor and a lawyer. So when it came to dealing with Frank Abagnale Jr., things were not always as they seemed to be. And he lived the good life for a number of years, but of course it didn't last, because things that are done the wrong way never do. He was eventually caught and did some jail time, but after that he was recruited by the government to help them to catch forgers and con artists. As they say, sometimes it takes one to know one. Well, Frank Abagnale Jr. isn't the only person who has ever made things seem different than they really are. There's nothing as frustrating as being deceived. I don't know about you, but I've been the naive victim of some scams over the years when I've been caught off guard or not looking for the right things or not asking the right questions. And I've made poor decisions because individuals that I've trusted were not fully honest with me. And perhaps you've been there too. Most of us think that we would be above that sort of thing, and I would certainly hope that none of us would be caught up in perpetrating a deliberate scam on people, even if it would mean making some good money. But still, many of us are guilty of being deceptive. We lead people to think certain things that are just not true. And even if we don't tell that outright lie, we can still deceive others in the way that we say things or in the things that we choose not to say. And I would have to say that some of the times when I've been the most deceived, I'm the one doing the deceiving. It's when I've been less than honest with myself. And I've chosen to believe things that, quite frankly, are just not the reality of the situation. This next sermon in our series on Joshua contains a story that many who regularly study the Bible don't even know is here. But in spite of the fact that it's not very well known, it's a story that captures our attention because it's full of the twists and the turns of a great story. But there's more. It's a story that can teach us how to deal with the deceptions of life. And that kind of makes sense for all of us. So let's go back to the first part of chapter 9, which describes this deception of Gibeon, starting in verse 1 of chapter 9. "Now, when all the kings west of the Jordan heard about these things, those in the hill country, in the western foothills, and along the entire coast of the great sea as far as Lebanon, the kings of the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, they came together to make war against Joshua and Israel. However, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and mended. The men put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, 'We have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us.' The men of Israel said to the Hivites, 'But perhaps you live near us. How then can we make a treaty with you?' 'We are your servants,' they said to Joshua. But Joshua asked, "Who are you and where do you come from?" They answered, "Your servants have come from a very distant country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth. And our elders and all those living in our country said to us, 'Take provisions for your journey. Go and meet them and say to them, "We are your servants. Make a treaty with us. This bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you, but now see how dry and moldy it is. And these wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are. And our clothes and sandals are worn out by the very long journey." The men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. Then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. All right, so now as we've been looking the last few weeks of the conquering of Jericho and of Ai eventually, after Achan's sin, they were able to overtake Ai. And the Canaanites had been afraid of the Jews long before these things happened. But now after the Jews had established that they were coming in to take possession of the land that God had given them, the rest of the territory went on high alert. And they knew it was only a matter of time until Joshua and his army would attack them. But the way that they responded would be very different. Several of the kings joined forces together so that they could try to defeat Israel together. But the city of Gibeon would take a very different approach. They would try to survive in an entirely different way. The leaders of the city decided that they would try to trick Joshua into signing a peace treaty with them. It's a pretty daring and creative plan that if it worked, it would mean that the people of their city would survive. The problem was that Gibeon was only 25 miles from the camp at Gilgal where Israel was, and they were right on Joshua's list of cities to be destroyed. And so the only way for the plan to succeed was for them to deceive the Jews into believing that they were from a city far, far away, because God had given strict instructions that they could not make peace with any of the cities in Canaan. The Canaanites' morals were not very high, as was the case of most of the other Canaanite cities, and so telling a lie was certainly no big deal to them. And many people get a little bit confused when it comes to lying. You know, some people think that, well, lies are okay as long as they are those little white ones. American political leader Adlai Stevenson once said, "A lie is an abomination to the Lord and a very present help in trouble," meaning, we may know that it's something that we shouldn't do, but if it will get us out of some trouble, then most people don't care if it's wrong. And so here's what the Gibeonites did. They showed up in the Jews' camp looking as if they'd been traveling for months. Their donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks, and their wineskins were old and cracked and had been mended. Their sandals looked like they just belonged in the bargain bin at the thrift store, and their food was dry and moldy. And they put on a pretty convincing show. Lies can sometimes be more convincing even than the truth is, but they can never be the truth. It all looked legitimate and real, but it wasn't. It was all a lie. But that brings us then to an important question. How was Joshua tricked by it? I mean, he had God, and he had all the spiritual resources of his relationship with the Lord, and God was certainly more than willing to help out if ever asked, but there was the problem. Joshua didn't ask. In fact, verse 14 makes the point very clearly for us when it says, "The men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord." So implied in that statement is the notion that if they had just asked, that God would have instructed them not to make this treaty. But they didn't ask. But before we just pile into Joshua and the other leaders, perhaps we need to ask an important question of ourselves. Why is it that we don't take time to pray when we are faced with various decisions? We may often remember to seek the Lord when there are choices that we need to make, but often we just don't. And I think there are several possible reasons for that. One is that we're just impatient and we don't take the time to pray. I expect that has described all of us at times. We're in a hurry, and while we don't like to admit it, for all practical purposes, we act like we really don't have time to pray. Reminds me of an old Jewish proverb I once heard that says, "We don't have the time to do things right, but we find the time to do them over." All too often, we just don't want to pray. We just want to jump in and do whatever it is that we think that needs to be done. Or another possibility is that we already know what we want to do, and we're afraid God might not agree. Surely you've been there when you've had one of those stubborn moments where even though you were dealing with God, you wanted just to do things your own way. For many business people and those dealing with bureaucracy and organizations and having to deal with all that red tape, they use this old adage, well, it's easier to ask forgiveness than it is to ask permission. And that might be true in some cases when you're dealing with a lot of government and organization, but not when you're dealing with God. If you're dealing with God, get permission first. To be honest, I think the third reason that we often don't pray about the little decisions we face is probably the most common for most of us. And that is that we think that we can figure things out for ourselves. Most of us are pretty independent, and we're proud about that. Many people would rather just do it the wrong way than to ask somebody else for help. And it's not just men I'm talking to, even though we're famous for the ones not wanting to stop and ask for directions. But any of us can be so strong-willed that we don't ask for help. And the truth is that we all have the tendency to walk by sight rather than to walk by faith. So relying upon ourselves to make decisions without consulting God was just going to get us into trouble every time. And so the Jews foolishly made a covenant with the enemy. Yes, it's true that Joshua and the leaders were impulsive and they didn't take time to consult the Lord, but that truth is that sounds pretty familiar to all of us. For the Christian, God's leadership isn't really optional. It's something that should be considered as required. I like the way well-known Bible teacher Warren Wiersbe put it in his commentary on Joshua. He wrote, "We don't seek God's will like customers considering our options, but like servants listening for orders. We must not forget that God wants to be intimately involved in our lives, in every decision that we make. He doesn't want to just be an afterthought. He wants to be central. He wants us to eagerly seek Him, not just for answers that we need, but for that personal relationship that we can have with Him." Perhaps that's part of what Paul had in mind when he wrote that we are to pray without ceasing. His point is that we are to be depending upon God every moment of our lives, whether we are formally in prayer at the moment or not. We just need to seek the Lord for the decisions that we need to make and wisdom that we need to have. So every moment of life can be like a prayer. We are to constantly rely upon God. So whenever we tell those little white lies or that we think that we have to deceive someone in order to get what we want, we're not relying on God. For a while, deception may actually look good, may appear to be good, but that never lasts because, secondly, deception eventually goes bad, which we see from the text that Susan read for us today. Something may look different than it really is for a while, but eventually reality is going to set in. This entourage from Gibeon had done their job very well in the sense that they did what they set out to do. But now that they got what they wanted, as the old saying goes, it's time to pay the piper. In this case, the Gibeon deception was to make themselves look worse than they really were so that they could get what they wanted. Now, usually when people deceive, it's the other way around. They try to make things look better than they really are. But still, the objective is just to get what you want. And they believe that they have to deceive others in order to get that. I read about a Virginia State Trooper who was a member of the bomb squad. He and his dog had become local celebrities when they found bombs at malls in Hampton and Virginia Beach. But that bit of celebrity evidently went to his head because a hidden camera later revealed that he was placing a bomb in a shed himself that he had been asked to search for explosives. And he was arrested and later pleaded guilty to placing explosives at two malls, a courthouse, and a coliseum. The bombs never exploded. He said he was just merely trying to enhance his image. Sooner or later, deception catches up to you. And when people find out that they've been deceived, they don't like it. Which often makes the consequences of that deception much worse. Really, is there anything more irritating than to find out that somebody has deceived you? You want them to pay for that somehow. But often, even though the deception is discovered, there is really nothing that you can do about it. If you've been scammed, then most of the time you just have to cut your losses and learn the hard way not to fall for that same scam the next time. We've all made the mistake of falling for deception. Makes us feel foolish, and we wonder how we could have been so stupid and gullible. And sometimes it gets us into a real mess. And by the time that we figure out that we've made a mistake, it's often too late for us to correct that. If we're lucky, there isn't that much of a price to pay. But Joshua was not so fortunate. He learned this tough principle the hard way. The fact that the Gibeonites had been dishonest didn't change the fact that the treaty had already been made. It was solemnized before God, and it could not be ignored. Joshua and the people couldn't undo what they had already done. They were just going to have to make the best of the situation that now did not look very good for them. But aren't you glad that even though when we make a mistake, that God is willing to forgive us? In spite of the fact that this wasn't God's perfect plan, God still made something good come out of it. As history reveals to us, the Gibeonites would eventually become very much a part of the Israelite nation. During Ezra and Nehemiah's time, the descendants of the Gibeonites were given the honorary title the Nethinim, which means the given ones, and they were given to help the priests carry out the sacred duties. And then here's what eventually happened over the years. The Gibeonites helped with the worship of God and gradually became to be a part of the nation. They came to accept God themselves. About 400 years later, David put the tabernacle at Gibeon. The altar and the priesthood were there. And at least one of David's mighty men was a Gibeonite. Nehemiah says that they were Gibeonites who helped rebuild the walls of Jerusalem after the captivity. So aren't you glad that even though when we make a big mess out of things, that God is willing to step in and to bail us out? And that's what he did for the Jews. Not that he has to, mind you. He doesn't. But God is a merciful God who certainly knows a whole lot better of what we need than we do. And he gives us a whole lot more than we deserve. And that fact sort of sets up the final point of this morning's sermon, in that even though deception might appear good, it eventually goes bad, but deception is no match for God. In chapter 10, we read about one of the most amazing miracles of all history. Attention shifted suddenly from Gibeon to Jerusalem, which was about 5 miles south. Near panic seized the king of Jerusalem. There are now 5 different kings that are trying to join forces to attack Gibeon. And here's why, because the Gibeonites were now viewed as traitors by their former friends because they had made this treaty with the Jews. And so since now they were allies with their enemies, the Gibeonites were now considered enemies of the rest of the Canaanites. In fact, when the Gibeonites realized that they were about to be attacked, they took advantage of this new alliance and they sent out a call to ask for Jewish help. We read about that in chapter 10, verse 6. The Gibeonites sent word to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us." So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth-horon and cut them down all the way from Azekah to Mekata. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth-horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky, and more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "O sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon over the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the nations avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jashar. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. When we look closely at this part of the story, we're going to see something very interesting. Now, the Jews found themselves in a situation that was not very good. However, in spite of the fact that they made a big mistake, God was still in the picture. God never views our mistakes as permanent. He can take our messes and he can create something good out of them. So let me explain what I'm talking about here. Now, before this all happened, the Jews were going to have to attack each of these separate city-states individually and try to get inside each of their walls and try to defeat their enemy. But now, God getting all these 5 of these kings together and deciding to join forces against the Jews, and it kind of took some of the complications out of the whole thing. He apparently made it possible to have his people take the land a lot more quickly than what would have happened otherwise. Though God was doing something far bigger, didn't change the fact that this new allegiance of kings had a different perspective and an agenda. They wanted to punish Gibeon for betraying the other nations, and they wanted to recapture the strategic area from the Israelites. But the Jews now had a section of the Promised Land that would help them to defeat the rest of their enemies. Now, if they would have had to retreat and to give up on Gibeon, it would be a huge setback. So there are a lot of different perspectives going into this. And evil may have appeared to win, but it didn't. Things are beginning to change. So when the attack began, Joshua asked God for an additional day of sunlight so that they could finish the battle that they had started. And God made that happen somehow. The sun just stopped. Now, technically, it would have been the earth that stopped rotating since the sun doesn't move, but that's how it would have looked to all those who were observing that the sun just stopped. Something that had never happened before, and it's never going to happen again. But on this one occasion, God pulled it off. Now, we could get into the technical way that it happened. I've heard various explanations, and I've read that there is scientific documentation that this really did occur. Although most of those explanations go over my head, but astronomers have calculated that there is a missing day in the historical calendar that would have gone back to the days of Joshua. But that's not really the point. The point is that God did it, and that's what really counts. We don't have to understand how God is doing everything in our lives to appreciate it either. We can just focus on the fact that He's God and not worry about anything else. So let me just kind of wrap this up with a story that kind of makes the point I'm trying to make. Ann Tyler, in her novel Morgan's Passing, told the story of a middle-aged Baltimore man. The novel opens with Morgan watching a puppet show on the lawn of a church on a Sunday afternoon. Not long into the puppet show, a young man comes from behind the puppet stage and asks, "Is there a doctor here?" There's a long pause. After 35 or 40 seconds of silence in the audience, Morgan stands up. Slowly and deliberately, he approaches the young man and asks, "What is the trouble?" The puppeteer's young wife is in labor, and the delivery seems imminent. Morgan puts the young couple in the back of a station wagon and sets off for Johns Hopkins Hospital. Halfway there, the husband cries, "The baby is coming!" Morgan, calm and assured, pulls to the curb and sends the about-to-be father to the newsstand to buy a Sunday paper as a substitute for the towels and bedsheets. He delivers the baby and then drives to the emergency room of the hospital, puts the mother and baby safely on a stretcher, and disappears. After the excitement dies down, the young couple ask for Dr. Morgan. They want to thank him, but no one has ever heard of a Dr. Morgan. They're puzzled. Frustrated, they can't express their gratitude to him. Several months later, they're pushing their baby in a stroller, and they see Dr. Morgan walking on the other side of the street. They run over and greet him, showing him the healthy baby that he brought into the world. They tell him how hard they look for him and about the hospital's incompetence in tracking him down. Then, in an unaccustomed gush of honesty, he admits to them that he is not really a doctor. In fact, he runs a hardware store. However, they needed a doctor, and being a doctor in those circumstances was not all that difficult. "You see, it's an image thing," he explains to them. "You discern what people expect, and you fit into it. You can get by with it in all the honored professions." This character, Morgan, had been doing this all his life. He had impersonated doctors and lawyers and pastors and counselors as the occasions presented themselves. He discovered that he could fake it, at least for a while. In a way, this is what a lot of people do their whole lives. They go through life just faking as if they know what they're doing. And some people get along quite well for quite a while until the truth just catches up to them. And as we finish up this morning, I want to ask you a very important question. When it comes to your spiritual life, have you been faking? It's easy to do. You can learn the lingo. You can get enough information that you can act like you know what the Christian life is all about. But if you don't really live it, you're just faking it because it gets you what you want for the time being. We must be careful that we are not deceived by others, but we must be even more careful that we don't deceive ourselves by thinking that we're all right with God and we can know deep down that we're really not. Deception can appear good, but it eventually goes bad. And it is no match for God. Remember that when you find yourself deceived by others. But also remember that when you were the one trying to do the deceiving, whether you're deceiving others or just deceiving yourself, don't fake living the Christian life. Really do it.